the National Archives podcast series, The Pleasures and Pains of Contemporary History, presented by Lord Hennessy.
May I open with a few words about the indispensability of good contemporary history for all the pitfalls and the problems which I'll come to shortly. Firstly, it helps, I think, to satisfy that bit of the human brain, the hippocampus, where memories are stored, and the compulsion, which is a product of possessing this particular lump of grey matter, to try and make sense of both our own individual memories and to try and make sense, too, of those we share with people we've lived amongst and institutions within which we've worked. In other words, I think it's a natural compulsion of the human being to have the kind of curiosity that brings us together tonight here. Secondly, it helps avoid what the great cosmologist Carl Sagan called the temporal chauvinism that those who reside in any epoch doubtless feel. Brian McGee, the philosopher, had another nice phrase for this. He called it being provincial in time. Thirdly, I'm not a history repeats itself man, but I am with Mark Twain when he said history doesn't repeat itself, but sometimes it rhymes. This links with a favourite remark of mine from the brilliant scientist Louis Pasteur, who declared, "Chance favours the prepared mind." Fourthly, for those in authority, as good a knowledge as possible is needed of how we got to where we are. And here, my dead mentor is John Buchan of 39 Steps fame, who wrote in his memoirs, "In the cycle in which we travel, we can only see a fraction of the curve." And he went on to say that sometimes that curve spans centuries, as indeed it does. So for me, contemporary history is a thing of both potent fascination and high utility. Now back to the archives. Nearly 47 years ago, I think, when as an undergraduate in that golden and highly desirable scholarly nursery called St John's College, Cambridge, I first began to read books heavily laden with the fruits of the archives, I had not the slightest conception, and I don't think most undergraduates have unless they come here, the slightest conception of the range and magnitude of the interlocking rules, practices and professions it took to deliver the learned product to the library shelves for forward transmission to my desk. I'm not sure, to be honest, that I have a full appreciation of it even now, but let me this evening take a stab at anatomising this great cooperative and indispensable enterprise. The first requirement, obviously, without which very little is possible, is good record keeping at source. Evermore a problem over the past 35 to 40 years, as we always talk when we're together about the electronic advances, which are breathtaking but bring problems of their own. And in those days of the Wilson Committee on Public Records, in the late 70s and early 80s, they were called machine-readable records. Isn't that a nice resonance about it? This, of course, is a problem that's grown exponentially with the advent of email and the partial loss of revealing comments scribbled on successive drafts, an integral part of the old style of policy-making by paper trail, which I've always enjoyed following. The second requirement is a good selection policy carried out by experienced and well-motivated record reviewers, the famous weeders, as they're called in Whitehall. When I did a story in The Times in 75, after going to see the weeders, the MOD ones, in the old Northumberland Hotel kitchens, now a hotel again, it caused a row, actually, on the following Monday. And Sir Michael Carey, a lovely man apparently, I didn't know him, the press summary featured this prominently over the weekend, with comments from AJP Taylor on The World this weekend. And as if he were Lady Bracknell, he wrote a minute saying, "What are weeders?" And it had to be explained, the system had to be explained to him. Anyway, you need wonderful weeders, and we do have them, with a feel for both the past frozen onto the pages that come before them, and with a sense of the likely appetites of future historians and their readers. Not easy, that. Allied to this is the need for sufficient resources in the coin of both people and money to be applied to the task. Ever more difficult in the freedom of information era, of course, which you may remember in the debates in the House of Commons, the Blair government said was going to be resource neutral. Isn't it wonderful how politicians can mistake hopes for facts? The lullabies they sing to themselves. But of course it couldn't be. And it has involved reviewers normally working on the rim of the 30-year rule, now 20 or shortly to be 20, being taken off the line to firefight FOI requests. And now, of course, as Ollie was saying, in the current fiscal circumstances, the needs of history are having to take their share of deficit reduction. The third requirement is for politicians in office to be sensitive not just to the needs of requirement number two, as I mentioned it, but of the indispensability of creating the archival equivalent of the Companies Act to regulate the trade in the official materials of the National Record and the collective memory of both government and Parliament alike. Should it be a 50-year cut-off as established by the Public Records Act 1958? It's fascinating to read the debates in the House of Lords when there was the proposal in 66 initially, if I remember, to bring the 50-year rule down to 30. And Rab Butler spoke in the House of Lords and said, 50 is unsafe, it should be longer. Now, this is one of his elaborate jokes. I did love Rab Butler, everything was an elaborate joke. But anyway, Harold Wilson was the great protagonist of the 30-year rule, and he got it through in the Public Records Act 1967, as we all know, and it became operational in January 1972. And the 20-year tariff, to which we're proceeding in stages, one extra year at a time, beginning next month, I think, the 1983 papers will be down here, thanks to the policies of the current coalition, which carried forward the intentions of the Brown government, itself acting on the recommendations of the Dacre report. And we did have in Tom McNally, who was Minister for Public Records initially in the coalition, somebody who's a great fan of the whole business. A lovely man, Tom. He has always been very kind for years at seeing my research students who I would send to him to talk to him about the International Monetary Fund crisis of 1976, when he was Jim Callaghan's senior policy advisor. So in Tom, we not only had a Minister for Public Records, he was a prime historical exhibit in his own person. The fourth requirement is a vigorous community of trained and sensitive historians, ranging from undergraduate thesis writers to the near senescent like me, keen to get their hands on the frozen history as it reaches the open shelves here at the National Archives. I would include, too, the band of seasoned National Archives hands in the media who regularly come to queue in this very room, actually, it happens, when a new tranche of material is available, and not just to the annual 30-year disclosures, or now 20 as we get going. We had a wonderful time in here just a few weeks ago with the first files ever from the Cabinet Secretary's Too Hot to Handle archive, which I knew existed. I just put down a parliamentary question asking if we can have the transcripts of the Denning inquiry into Profumo, which went in there. I suspect not, because a lifelong guarantee was given. I still haven't caught up with the Profumo affair, because it's one of the great myths of the 60s, that we're all terribly liberated and so on. I remember it was my O-level year in my grammar school in Gloucestershire in 63, and we all pretended to be men of the world, of single sex, you know. We hadn't the faintest idea about what these revelations in the papers were, but we all had to pretend we did. I still don't think I've caught up with that somehow. I'm confessing this to you, but I'm genuinely baffled by all that. I've led such a sheltered life. Anyway, ours is a cryogenic trade, and unlike the medical equivalent, ours really works. For what else are those minutes and memoranda, cabinet papers and cost-benefit analyses, intelligence assessments and the war books, but frozen history? And our job is to warm them up until they twitch a little bit, their limbs begin to move, their diaphragms begin to heave, until at last they begin to talk to us, and we can ask questions of them. Now, there are pitfalls, of course. Already we must know who these people are, whose product we're reading, what routes brought them to the Cabinet Committee table or the Chiefs of Staff suite. We have to know, too, what the world was like when they were 20 years old as well as in their maturity, because one of Napoleon's tests for understanding the people he was dealing with was that. Think of the world when a man or woman was 20, if you want to understand them. Unless we have a sense of this, we'll end up shouting at them. I've been a bit prone to this over the years, shouting, surely you must have known this, oh, how on earth can you have failed to anticipate that? And that's subjecting them to what Edward Thompson famously called the enormous condescension of posterity, which historians must not do, tempting though it is. Our job, in essence, is to fulfil the duty placed upon us by the incomparable French historical sociologist Raymond Aron, when he said that the scholar's task is to restore the same level of uncertainty in the past as we feel today about the future. And that's why this paper trail that ends up here, this frozen residue of state activity, is so precious. The fifth requirement, however, is to remember always and everywhere that getting the documents to talk is not enough on its own if history is to live and breathe as fully as we can make it with our efforts at revival. Speaking to participants and survivors is indispensable, and contemporary historians like me and my students have a duty to do so. Take a famous example. Clem Attlee's Cabinet Committee on Atomic Energy meeting on the afternoon of Friday the 25th of October 1946, to decide whether or not to authorise the building of a gaseous diffusion plant without which manufacturing the ingredients of a British atomic bomb would not be possible. From Sir Denis Ricketts' meticulous, classically drafted Cabinet Secretariat minutes, you would acquire no feel at all for the drama of the occasion or a particular piece of language that has echoed down three and more decades of the great UK nuclear weapons debate since we first heard about it from a scientific civil servant who was present at that Cabinet Committee that day in a BBC Time Watch interview in 1982. The great in every sense Ernie Bevin, Attlee's Foreign Secretary, wheezed in after a good, and I suspect liquid, lunch, late. By the time he arrived in the Cabinet Committee, Gen 75, to give it its Cabinet Office to classification, the committee was in the process of being talked out of a British bomb, before we had one, by the Economic Ministers Hugh Dalton and Stafford Cripps, Chancellor of the Exchequer and President of the Board of Trade, respectively, on the grounds of what we would now call opportunity cost. That the country couldn't afford the diversion of scarce engineering resources from economic recovery and exports. Ernie Bevin, as we know from that 1982 testimony of Sir Michael Perrin, who was one of the Ministry of Supply's team at the meeting, Ministry of Supply did the bomb in those days, was having none of this, and he went critical. "That won't do at all," he roared. "We've got to have this. I don't mind for myself, but I don't want any other foreign secretary of this country to be talked to or at by a Secretary of State in the United States, as I've just had with in my discussion with Mr. Burns," Truman's Secretary of State. And here comes the passage that's resonated down the years. "We've got to have this thing over here, whatever it costs. We've got to have the bloody Union Jack on top of it." On the way back to the Ministry of Supply in the Strand from No. 10, Lord Portal, the World War II Chief of the Air Staff and now Controller of Production of Atomic Energy, turned to Perrin and said, "You know, if Bevin hadn't come in then, we wouldn't have had that bomb, Michael." Now, here's the frozen history version in the shape of Denis Ricketts' minute. And I'm in no way critical of Denis Rickett, because this is what the job of the Secretariat is to do. To shringe of passion, just to cover the essentials and to say what action was decided. In discussion, it was urged that we must consider seriously whether we could afford to divert from civilian consumption and the restoration of our balance of payments the economic resources required for a project on this scale. Unless present trends were reversed, we might find ourselves faced with an extremely serious economic and financial situation in 2 or 3 years' time. On the other hand, it was argued that we couldn't afford to be left behind in a field which was of such revolutionary importance from an industrial, no less than from a military point of view. Our prestige in the world, as well as our own chances of securing American cooperation, would both suffer if we did not exploit to the full the discovery in which we played a leading part at the outset. Now, see, the official note, as always, conveys the essentials, but it comes nowhere near to capturing the atmospherics. And Ernie Bevin's force majeure and his unusual vocabulary is not captured either. And the question of the bomb has been one of our longest policy psychodramas from that day to this. And as always, we have a decision to make when the money's run out. There's a malign combination that happens. The sixth requirement is a wholly owned responsibility of the historians as tellers of the tale. For unless they subscribe to the great Macaulay tradition of writing it up in such a way that it creates an appetite to be widely read, all that formidable infrastructure, physical and human, of good record-keeping, clear and sensible public records legislation, helpful and well-crafted reviewing criteria, and a well-run and scholar-sensitive national archives, all this great collective effort will be in vain. And I'm biased here, of course, because I've grown up in the Max Bygrave School of History. I want to tell you a story. I'm so glad to be talking to a group who can remember who Max Bygrave was. By this, I don't mean that dreadful postmodernist tosh of creating a master narrative. I have to say, when the word narrative is mentioned, I reach for my tranquilizers. A master narrative, of course, is a delusion. It invariably distorts, and it always ends in tears. The gods of history are wrathful bastards, wonderfully adept at biting in the bum any politician or political party who attempts to hijack the historical craft for propaganda purposes. May I talk a little bit about what I call catch-up history before a few final thoughts on the pleasures and pains of writing the history of one's own country in one's own time, or in times, rather. For catch-up history is a branch of the trade to which I've devoted a considerable amount of effort over the last 20 years, as have my students at Queen Mary, the Mile End Road, Much, though not all of it, has been Cold War related, intelligence material, nuclear weapons policy making files, nuclear release procedure drills, transition to World War III exercises, understandably deemed too sensitive, too current, to release while the Cold War lasted, and held back, therefore, from the great tranches of files opened each January under the 30-year rule, as was allowed for in the exemptions from disclosure permitted by the Public Records Act. Now, quite often, the catalogues down here, as you know, would contain an indication of the kind of material retained, and this was of considerable importance when we got our breakthrough in the early to mid-1990s under the so-called Walgrave Initiative. Let me explain its genesis briefly. I'm sure you know it. In 1992, when William Walgrave was John Major's Cabinet Office Minister with responsibility for open government and a huge appetite for history of his own, William was a natural scholar, I prepared a BBC Radio 4 analysis documentary on open government and freedom of information with my producer Chris Westcott. William gave us an interview during which he announced, in response to an earlier letter of mine, that the minutes and memoranda of the Joint Intelligence Committee would, once reviewed, be lifted out from beneath the so-called blanket ban on intelligence-related records, put in place for 25 years initially when the 1967 Public Records Act was passed. Now, William seemed full of pep that afternoon. It was almost as if he got carried away. He would, he said, after announcing the Joint Intelligence Committee breakthrough, like historians to let him know what other files they would wish to have re-reviewed with a view to the classification. This sounded to me like a post-Cold War documentary equivalent of a peace dividend. Then William really took flight and suggested, with the tape recorder running, that a white paper on open government might be a good idea as well. At this point, his private secretary's face changed like the weather in April, and he began to take verbatim notes. Now, this was serious stuff, I thought, and unexpected too. A new approach and a white paper, plus a code of practice on access to government information, duly appeared in 1993. Now, following Lord Waldegrave's words on analysis, the Institute of Contemporary British History, the ICBH, swiftly organised two weekend meetings when historians mingled with Whitehall's departmental record officers and staff from here, which was still the Public Record Office. Wish lists were compiled. By the time Whitehall stopped counting in 1998, 96,000 files had been re-reviewed and released. I reckon it's well over double that now. The Walgrave Initiative has produced a veritable cornucopia of rolling declassifications and has enabled us to fill in many of the gaps in post-war history, especially the structures and the preoccupations of the Cold War secret state, which we built and adapted over the 40 years of the great East-West confrontation. It's given us, really, when you think about it, the equivalent of a new currency with which to trade. And fine theses, increasingly being converted into books, have begun to flow on intelligence, home and civil defence, nuclear drills, war books, and transition to war exercises. Now, could it be time for a Walgrave 2, another rescanning of retained files that were still deemed too sensitive for release during Walgrave 1? This, of course, has happened. The war books have started coming out. Cabinet Office very kindly started that process in May 2009 by getting out for us the Central Government War Book of 1970, the first one of its kind to see the light of day in full. And Tom McNally, when he was still Minister, when we had a debate in the House of Lords in January 2012, said he was deeply sympathetic but there wasn't any money. And I do understand that, but it's a great pity, because I think it's exemplary, the Walgrave Initiative, because, as we know, you need runs of documents, not little fragment bits from FOI. It's what historians need. And proactive releases, like the ones we had in this very room a few weeks ago with the Permanent Undersecretary's Department files, you know, the link between the Foreign Office and the SIS, from the 30s right up to 1951. Big proactive releases, that's what we need. I can't tell you how many good PhDs I'm sure will come out of that release just a few weeks ago. I mean, really good ones. A final thought on the pleasures and pains of writing about one's own time. There's real satisfaction to be found in mining the collective experiences of one's own generation and mingling it with one's own individual recollection. It's part of what Melvyn Bragg calls generational kinship. The pleasure becomes, I think, particularly exquisite when one finds oneself an exhibit oneself, the subject of a number 10 document declassified under the 30-year rule. And I've had a lot of fun because of this, because it's usually, in my case, been a leak inquiry file dating from my time as the Times Whitehall correspondent coming down here. Terribly funny. People get terribly cross. And Bernard Ingham, who's a friend of mine, I did a documentary on the 100th anniversary 2 years ago of the 1911 Official Secrets Act Section 2, which covered everything, as you remember, and blanket coverage. And Bernard and I get on very well now. We didn't when he was Mrs. Thatcher's press secretary and I was a pushy youth on the Times at all. My fault, mainly. Anyway, Bernard and I get on very well, but suddenly I gave him one of these declassified leaking files from his time, and he began to, not quite shake, he began to change colour, certainly, and got very cross with me. And it turned out he was furious with the senior civil service for telling me things they weren't telling him. And I said, well, everybody's got to talk to somebody, Bernard. He said, yes, but they were talking to you, not me. And then I shouldn't have said it. I said, could it be that the beauty of your personality was lost on them? And Bernard, I'm sorry I said that to him because I do like him. And he said, it's nothing to do with the beauty of my personality. The rank hypocrisy of these people. But there it was, you see, this cold history suddenly produced... Bernard, you know, heat came off Bernard at the thought of this particular episode, or episodes in my case. So it's great fun when you turn up in a file down here. It's one of the great pleasures in life. Now, there are dangers, of course, writing in history of one's own times. I've just exhibited them. One is of excessive emotional involvement, but more widely. This was vividly illustrated during an ICBH seminar at the London School of Economics in July 1991, on the writing of contemporary history, with Enoch Powell on the platform and Paul Addison in the chair. And unwittingly, I lit Enoch's blue touch paper when I reckoned in my opening words that soon the historical torch would have to pass on the question of Suez, the Suez affair, to a younger generation. I was mid-40s at the time. People, I said, who are free of nostalgia, who are not susceptible to the old drumbeat, people who don't get a spasm of one kind or another when the word Suez is mentioned. And Enoch was the first discussant after my lecture. And he turned to Paul Addison, his voice with that amazing combination of air raid siren and West Midlands accent, rising up and up and up, brimming with emotion. He declared, I'll just do a bit of the voice, only a bit. Mr. Chairman, I found myself in far-reaching sympathy with the cry from the heart with which Dr. Hennessy ended his lecture. I think he's right to put his finger upon a factor which the historian chronically neglects, the emotional factor. Of course, one understands why the historian neglects it. It is unquantifiable, it is rather shameful, and it is difficult to handle. But without the emotional factor, I do not think one can understand the turnaround which occurred in this country, or some of the most surprising things which this country did in the second half of the 20th century. And the young American scholars in the audience had never experienced a man like this. They sat there like this. Unbelievable. He was 79 at the time, you know. And then he carried on. And I won't do his voice now. I resigned my chair in Australia in 1939. He'd been appointed professor of classics at Sydney at the age of 25. In order to come home to enlist, had I been asked what is the state whose uniform you wish to wear and in whose service you expect to perish, I would have said the British Empire. I also know that on my deathbed I shall still be believing with one part of my brain that somewhere on every ocean there is a great grey ship with 3 funnels and 16-inch guns which can blow out of the water any other navy which is likely to face it. He was off again. Then came the peroration and the eyes were dilating, his, the audience, not his. They were mesmerised. I know it is not so. Indeed, I realise at a relatively early age that it is not so. But that factor, the emotional factor, will not die until I, the carrier of it, am dead. He sat down. Sat down. Impossible to follow. Died some years later. Tricky chap emotion. That's me, not Enoch. There is another risk, too, in the shape of survivors' memories, but they don't blow you away like Enoch Powell's 16-inch guns did. But invaluable and indispensable as the survivors' memories can be, they can be a bit of a pain. Shortly before, I submitted the manuscript of my study of early post-1945 Britain, Never Again, to my publisher. I bumped into Lord Sherfield, Roger Makins, who'd been a great figure in the Foreign Office after the war, and a great friend to archives, actually. Now, Roger was very keen on knowing what was coming out down here. What have you been finding lately, he said. I said, I found a really good story about you and Jean Monnet and the plan for a European coal and steel community when he outlined it to you and Edwin Plowden that spring day in May 1950 in his room in the Hyde Park Hotel. What story, said Roger. This wasn't in the archives, actually, but still. How you ended the meeting with the words, we're not ready and you will not succeed, which just about summed up beautifully, I thought, the British attitude to Europe. Well, some would say it still does. I can't remember saying that, said Roger. Etienne Hirsch, Monet's assistant, says you did in his memoirs. He's dead. In fact, they're all dead apart from me, said Roger. Ever since, I've had to caveat that story, you see, which is a real pain that Lord Sherfield denies ever having said it, because it did capture everything. As did Herbert Morrison's equivalent when it was brought to him in the back. If ever you have lunch in the Ivy, the place where they store the chairs at the back is very historic, because Herbert Attlee was in hospital with ulcers, and Herbert Morrison was acting Prime Minister, and they brought this plan, Edwin Plowden and Robert Hall, the Chief Economic Advisor to Treasury, to Morrison, who was having a supper party after having been to the theatre. And he looked at it and he said, we can't do it, the Durham miners won't wear it. Well, that said everything then, but you have to explain it to the undergraduates, because there are no mines in Durham. You have to explain that the Durham miners had just come back from being the Durham Light Infantry and fought their way across Italy and Europe. Great, great regiment. How the pits had been nationalised, they wanted the steelworks to be nationalised. It carried everything, but it takes a lot of explaining. But Morrison did say that, and also he's dead, so he can't take it away from me. Such episodes of survivors snatching away a great line, however, are a small price to pay for the pleasure and the instruction to be had by retreading the road trod by one's own country in one's own times. A nation has a duty of care to its collective memory and the documentary particles that go into its making. The preservation of those files created for official purposes and their release as soon as safely as possible to the public as well as to historians is a rolling parliamentary responsibility. And a responsibility of the state. So can I finish this evening by thanking all of those up and down the supply chain, from the day of creation of the document to the moment of its release here at the National Archives. We can't do without you, and we're deeply appreciative. Thank you very much.
This talk was recorded on the 11th of June 2013 at the National Archives, Kew. This talk was sponsored by the Friends of the National Archives. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.